Karzai drifts further away. Today, Thursday, February 13th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Afghan President Hamid Karzai releases 65 prisoners that the U.S. still wants behind bars. His former Pentagon advisor doubts Karzai's claims that the men are innocent.
It seems unlikely that these are simply ordinary farmers who are going about their business all day, every day.
We'll hear what this release means for U.S.-Afghan relations. Also today, why making films in Iran can be so frustrating.
Can you imagine how many stories you are unable to tell as a filmmaker if you cannot show the slightest physical touch between members of the opposite sex?
Plus, the outgoing U.S. ambassador in Moscow tells us what he'll miss about life in Russia, and comedian Carl Reiner remembers Sid Caesar's nonsensical foreign languages.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. U.S. forces have been risking their lives in Afghanistan for over a decade, and a key part of their mission is putting away the bad guys, the captured enemy fighters. Well, today, Afghan President Hamid Karzai angered the U.S. by releasing 65 of those prisoners. They've been held in the Bagram prison facility, which the U.S. handed over to the Afghan government last year. Karzai insists the men he released are innocent and calls the prison a Taliban-making factory. The Afghan leader told the BBC he first heard that phrase several years ago from a man who'd been released.
On his release, he asked to see me. And when I met with him, he said, "Mr. President, this is not a prison where they take criminals, but this is a prison where they take innocent Afghans and turn them against their own country and government."
The U.S. has strongly condemned Karzai's decision to let those 65 prisoners go, and the Pentagon released a detailed dossier on each detainee. Sarah Chase is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She lived in Afghanistan for years, working for a nonprofit and as an advisor to the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. So Karzai maintains these men are innocent, but I've seen the dossiers. I don't know if you've seen them that the Pentagon pulled together, but they do seem to have the goods on them. So is this innocent even plausible in your view?
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to know, obviously, without looking at the evidence oneself. There is always an issue between intelligence and evidence. But given the specificity of the dossier that you're talking about, it seems unlikely that these are simply ordinary farmers who are going about their business all day, every day.
I mean, even Karzai admits that Bagram is a Taliban-making factory. Those are his words, repeating them. Why would he then release the detainees?
That's the more interesting and complicated question. And it really ties into what I've seen as a certain consistency in President Karzai's actions, not his words, but his actions, going back as far as 2002 or 2003. There were times when I was really surprised to see individuals that he had appointed to government positions in particular locales, when I knew those appointees had a close background either to the Pakistani intelligence agency or the Taliban themselves in earlier days. So if you look at this pattern, I mean, Karzai himself was incredibly instrumental in getting the Taliban into Afghanistan in the first place in 1994 and ensuring that they would basically be able to walk into Kandahar from across the border in Pakistan where they had first been organized. And I'm not saying that Karzai himself is a, you know, driven ideological conservative Muslim. I am saying that there's a really consistent pattern that he has shown in, let's just say, respecting the objectives of the Pakistani military intelligence agency and its objectives in Afghanistan. And that sounds very counterintuitive, but the pattern of his actions has been pretty clear.
I mean, it also sounds like you're saying that Karzai is more complicit with the Taliban than we realize. Why has this not emerged before?
I think it's just so counterintuitive that it's just very, very hard for Americans to digest. And as I said, it was so shocking to me, some of these appointments that he made and some other advice that he was giving to the international military leadership about where they should deploy forces and this and that, that I started looking into it as far back as 2003. And that's when I discovered this very thick tissue of relationship with the emerging Taliban in early 1994 and his persistent connection to them for several years afterwards.
Sarah Chay, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Always great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
From one complex U.S. foreign policy challenge to perhaps the most intractable one, the Mideast peace process, Secretary of State John Kerry has been pushing hard for a new agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. He envisions a deal that establishes a Palestinian state alongside Israel. The Israeli government has many views about that one. In fact, there are ministers inside the same ruling coalition fighting over Kerry's plan. Reporter Daniel Estrin has more.
Israeli lawmakers from across the political divide throw insults at each other all the time. But what's happening these days is different. Ministers from within the governing coalition are attacking each other, very publicly, mostly about the peace process. A lawmaker in parliament the other day rattled off a list of recent insults between ministers. When the foreign minister said that the unity of the nation is more important than keeping the West Bank, economy minister Naftali Bennett said he was flip-flopping and called him a lefty, a double insult. Bennett also accused the prime minister of moral confusion. The prime minister threatened to fire him if he didn't apologize. The justice minister attacked the deputy defense minister. The list goes on.
Einer besonderen privilegierten Partnerschaft.
Then there was yesterday's brouhaha. European Union Parliament President Martin Schulz gave a speech in German and questioned whether Israel was denying Palestinians some access to much-needed water. The economy minister's hardline party stormed out of the Israeli Knesset halfway through the speech. When we are spat upon and lies are told, I will not shut up, ever, the minister said.
We are remaining our agenda, and we promote it, and we're not afraid.
That's Yoni Shetbun, a lawmaker in the economy minister's pro-settler party called Jewish Home. It's one thing for his Jewish Home party to protest world figures like the EU Parliament president for comments on Palestinians. But his party is in the prime minister's cabinet and criticizing its own political partners, the prime minister included. But Shetbun says he doesn't want you, the American listener, to get the wrong impression.
When the citizens in the United States hear they think that the Jewish Home is the extremist party. No, my role is to defend our interests. The Palestinian state, it's not the solution for our conflict.
So if his party does not believe in negotiating the creation of a Palestinian state on land Israel occupies, which is what his coalition partners are doing right now, why doesn't his party leave the coalition?
Our role, it's to maintain Netanyahu on the right side of the political map of Israel.
That is, to make sure Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does not sign a deal for a Palestinian state. This is a most unusual governing coalition.
Normally, those coalitions are relatively cohesive on one issue. And it's usually the Palestinian issue that you'll have all doves or you'll have all hardliners together with some centrists.
Gil Hoffman is chief political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. He says there is one thing, though, that coalition partners are working on together, and that's a law expected to pass soon that requires asking the nation whether to give up land for a Palestinian state.
And then it would be brought to a referendum which is a political tool of a coward that says, I don't want to decide. People, you decide. And then if the people say yes, which all polls say they would, then it could very well be that Bennett or others will say, you know, I'm going to argue with the people.
With an impossible coalition of ministers who want to leave the West Bank and ministers who do not want to leave the West Bank, perhaps letting the people make the tough choices could be one way to keep the Israeli government from tearing itself apart. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
One thing Israeli politicians usually agree on is Iran. But leave that aside for our next story, which is set in Iran. It's about making movies in the Islamic Republic. Iran's biggest movie showcase, the Fajr Film Festival, wrapped up yesterday. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
It's like the Oscars and Cannes rolled into one, only smaller and much more Islamic. There's the red carpet, cameras, celebrities, you know, the usual. Except that it takes place in Iran. And instead of the golden statue, there's the crystal Simurgh, a bird from the Persian mythology. In recent years, some filmmakers have boycotted the festival, saying it celebrates the limited, censored movies that the government thinks are appropriate. You see, in Iran, no movie gets made unless it passes several rounds of inspections. And the inspection board isn't just looking at the political.
What makes the censorship in Iran so unique to the point that I think it deserves a chapter of its own in the film history, a chapter of shame, I must say, is the imposition of some highly restrictive Islamic codes regarding the representation of women and their interactions with men.
That's Jamshid Akrami, an Iranian filmmaker based in the U.S. In his latest documentary, A Cinema of Discontent, he sits down with a dozen filmmakers who are battling it out every day in Iran.
Can you imagine how many stories you are unable to tell as a filmmaker if you cannot show the slightest physical touch between members of the opposite sex? You know, we're talking about situations where you cannot even show parental affection through physical touch.
In the documentary, the well-known Iranian filmmaker Behman Farmanara talks about facing that dilemma in his movie called The Little Kiss.
There's a sequence where the father, after 38 years of being in Switzerland, has returned suddenly because his son has committed suicide, and he comes to visit his daughter. Obviously, according to the laws that we have to obey, a man and a woman cannot embrace each other, even though in this particular instance they are supposedly father and daughter.
And here's how he gets around it.
So what I did, which added actually in a way helped the character that the man was playing, the writer was playing, when the daughter takes a few steps towards him, he takes his hat off. So he makes a move to stop her from coming close.
Farmanara says the need to keep a distance becomes absurd.
We are a nation that in our films we don't kiss, we don't touch, we don't hug. But somehow, miraculously, from 37 million, we've gone to 70 million.
If you've watched enough Iranian films, you're actually somewhat shocked when the characters do touch or dance. Like in this scene in a movie called Gilane, where a mother who takes care of her disabled son bathes him, moves him around, and even starts dancing to cheer him up. Just imagine all the raised eyebrows when that movie came out. Making a film in Iran is a cat-and-mouse game. Sometimes directors and actors haggle with the censors. One actress talked about fighting just to show a lock of hair. And yet, with all those limitations, Iranian films are getting made and receiving international recognition.
And the Oscar goes to Separation, Iran, Asghar Farhadi.
2 years ago, director Asghar Farhadi made history by winning an Oscar in the foreign language film category.
I proudly offer this award to the people of my country.
And with a new president in Iran, there's a different atmosphere at this year's film festival. Tehran filmmaker Mahdi Kuhian says he attended for the first time in 4 years. He says people were a lot less excited about the festival when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was president. But now, with Hassan Rouhani, there's a much more positive feel. Akrami, though, isn't as optimistic.
You know, the election of Mr. Rouhani, to me, is just a cosmetic change. It's like putting makeup on a monster, which basically wouldn't change the nature of that monster. You still have a monster.
He says Iran has seen periods like this before, where things eased up to some extent. And then it's just a matter of time before they get back to where they were. For him, the saddest part about Iranian cinema is that its best movies never got to be made. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Still ahead on The World, Love American Muslim Style on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's been a while since we've seen and heard so much about Russia all at once. We have the Sochi Olympics to thank for a lot of that, but also the current tension between Moscow and Washington. That's not to say there are no areas where Russia and the U.S. share common ground, but it's a far cry from the famous reset President Obama wanted back in 2009. One of the big thinkers behind that reset was current U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. He's getting ready to leave his post after 2 years in Moscow. From his residence in the Russian capital, McFaul told me that Washington's relations with Moscow are bound to be contradictory.
That would be the theme, I think, of our relationship with Russia as I'm about to leave, that amidst difficult arguments over the transition in Syria, deterioration of democracy and human rights in Russia, the banning of adoptions for American parents, you have that in one category. And right next to it, you have continuity of cooperation on issues like Iran, North Korea, Afghanistan, trade and investment issues. And that's the nature of the relationship. It's not one way or the other. It's not black and white. Some cooperation, some disagreement.
Earlier this week, Ambassador, you charged the Kremlin with wiretapping your phone calls. I'm just wondering, is that any different, do you think, than what the NSA does?
Well, what happens? I'm the ambassador to Russia, right? So my issues are to deal with the bilateral relationship, and therefore, as we warn in every travel advisory to people coming to this country, you should assume no privacy. And, I most certainly don't here as somebody that they might have a lot of interest in. That's their system.
With your Twitter feed, it's quite an interesting approach to diplomatic communications. You have started to blur the lines between the public and the personal. I'm just wondering, what do you think your pretty active Twitter feed accomplished?
Before I got to Russia, I'd never seen a tweet ever. I was brand new to this world. I was encouraged by Secretary Clinton and her advisors on this digital diplomacy to dive in, be active, especially in a country like Russia, where it's a huge country, difficult to go and meet 60,000 people like I have following me. I can't meet 60,000 people in a year probably around the country. This gives me a chance to communicate directly to them. And my 14,000 Facebook friends, by the way. The purpose of trying to create interest in me and in our country and in our administration was to give us a chance to explain directly to the Russian people what our policy is and what our country is all about. And why we need to do it directly is because on some media channels here, especially television that are close to the government, we can't do that through those channels. I personally never have told my team here, we're not trying to convince people that we're right, or we're not trying to convince people to like us more. I think that's a big misconception. We're trying to get the facts across about who we are as a country and what our policies are vis-a-vis Russia.
It's pretty clear that the Russian establishment considered you a provocateur of sorts from early on when you arrived there. Along with the Twitter feed and these kind of innovative ways of getting the message across, do you think that perception kind of boxed you into a corner?
Well, they most certainly wanted to do that. I think you're correct in that, and portray me as some unusual person sent here to foment revolution, which was, obviously a ridiculous claim. I would note the irony that the first meeting I had with the Russian opposition leaders was actually not organized by me, but it was organized on behalf of the Deputy Secretary of State, one of the most experienced diplomats we have in our government. I had nothing to do with that. But that said, it is our policy as a government that we meet with the Russian government and we meet with society. They don't have an interest in us doing that, of course. They want to portray what we're doing in a certain way. And for me to have the ability to communicate and meet directly with Russian people, that doesn't serve their interest. But, I understand that. I perfectly understand their strategy. I don't lament it. I think we have, over time, been effective in getting our message across.
What's the one thing about Russia you really would not have predicted going in 2 years ago?
The thing that is striking to me is the paradox that I experience almost on a weekly basis, but I just experienced it down in Sochi. which is that on the one hand, there is this rhetoric about how evil we are and how we're doing all these nasty things around the world. And from time to time, it's been about me personally. And yet, when I was walking around down in the Olympic Park, number one, lots of people know who I am. I did not expect to be known in the way that I am. And number two, especially of the young volunteers that were down there, and you've probably seen them on television in their really colorful jackets, they all want photographs of me. They all want autographs with me. Mm. That says something, I think, about their schizophrenic way of thinking about our country. Because on the one hand, there's this official piece, and on the other hand, there's this pure, genuine respect, I would even say affinity and curiosity from the Russian people about the United States of America.
And yet for many Russians, it seems, at least polls that I've seen, they seem to support Putin and what he has on the agenda.
And that's the contradiction that I think is important for people to understand, that you can be a supporter of President Putin, and there's no doubt about it, he is a very popular leader here in Russia, and also want to have your autograph with the American ambassador, I mean your photo with the American ambassador. That may seem like a contradiction to us. It is not to many people here in Russia.
Ambassador, your expertise in Russia was pretty deep before you arrived. How did you fall in love with Russia in the first place, and what are you going to miss most?
Well, I was attracted to Russia as a kid in high school in Montana for political reasons. It was a tense time. It was a Cold War. And I had a simple belief that if we just could communicate better, understand each other, that would reduce tensions. And so as a young kid, I went to Stanford as an undergraduate, and my first trip abroad ever in my life was to the Soviet Union in 1983, motivated by that very idealistic idea. And in some ways, I still believe that. I mean, I know more, obviously, but I do think more communication, more information between our two countries does reduce tensions, and it won't mean that we'll agree on everything. But at least the disagreements we have will be based on facts and not based on misperceptions or untruths, right? And in many ways, that's exactly what I've been doing here for the last 2 years. What I'll miss, I will miss the intensity of individual relationships that I have with Russian colleagues and Russian friends. That day-to-day experience of talking about serious stuff, using your mind, but also not being afraid to bring your emotions into it. That's something I deeply admire among my Russian friends, and I'll miss that for sure.
Well, if you miss it too much, I hear the class struggle is really heating up in San Francisco, so you won't be too far away.
Okay.
U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul will step down from his post later this month. He joined us from Moscow. Great to speak with you again. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, Muslim men and love. It's complicated, says this Egyptian-American, even when playing Spin the Bottle.
There was probably about four or five of us. I was the only Muslim kid. It was the first time I ever kissed a girl. But my mom found out, and I got the silent treatment for several days.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. So you've been watching the Olympics on TV late at night. You've seen all those features about Sochi and the mountain venues, and you feel like you know the place, right? Well, there's a lot more to Sochi and its surrounding region than what we're seeing on NBC or online. Filmmaker Arnold Van Bruggen has spent the past 5 years traveling back and forth to Sochi, Abkhazia, and the North Caucasus region. He's part of a multimedia team that's been documenting Sochi's transformation for these Olympics. Van Bruggen says the idea for the Sochi project came up right after the Black Sea Resort was chosen to host the Winter Olympics.
So we saw this region full of contrast, Olympic Winter Games happening in the subtropical summer resort, right on the edge of a conflict zone, and on the other side of the mountains, another conflict zone. And we thought this is too interesting to not spend 5 years working at, actually.
I mean, there's an interesting mix in your photographs of kind of nostalgia for the old Sochi, the Florida of Russia, but cheaper. How much of that kind of old school Sochi is still intact, or was some of it removed to prepare for the Olympics?
Yeah, a lot, because actually this is really a famous place throughout the Soviet Union, indeed. Lenin said after the revolution, we have to make Sochi a huge holiday resort for all the laborers of the Soviet Union, for the proletariat. And that's what they did, actually. These sanatoria, these like huge spas, actually, they are fantastic palaces. They were built in a neoclassicist style or in a modernist way. This is really Sochi culture. And what's happening over the years, these sanatoria are quite famous in the Soviet Union because people were allowed to spend free holidays over here. They spent like 4 to 6 weeks here to cure whatever disease they got working on farms or in mines or factories. Now these big sanatoria, this ancient tradition in the Soviet Union, are being transformed into 3 to 5 star hotels. And the spa facilities have disappeared in many cases. And in between all these beautiful green garden palaces, they built these high rises, you know.
So once you leave kind of Sochi proper, how far away from the city does the scene change from these new luxury high-rise hotels to that poverty, that rural poverty that you saw?
If you speak about Sochi itself, it's really everywhere in between. You know, if you go to a sanatorium, some small neighborhood behind the sanatorium can be those self-built, small, ramshackle houses. People still live there, but now they set up giant blue fences, you know, to make sure the visitors of the Olympic Games don't see these ramshackle neighborhoods.
When you traveled around Abkhazia and the North Caucasus, what were people's attitudes toward the Olympics?
Well, partly it's the same as in Sochi itself. People looked at these games almost like spaceships landed down in their region. It was something so surreal and otherworldly. In the North Caucasus, people have their issues of their own, you know. They don't care about winter sports at all. They just saw this huge event being organized in Sochi against this huge cost, which were unimaginable for their life standards. So they didn't actually really care about it. They just saw the huge cost and thought, hey, this is bizarre, right? I mean, there are better ways to spend this money. And the same in Abkhazia, I think they really tried to profit from these games because they were right at Abkhazia's border. But in the end, the border with Sochi has been closed for security reasons.
So you're actually not speaking with us from Sochi. You're in Hamburg because you're actually banned from going to Russia. Why is that?
Well, I think it's really because of this. Because we didn't see Sochi as this isolated event happening in Sochi only. That's the ideal picture, so to say. We always saw these games as happening in the context of this wider region, in the midst of these conflict zones, with all these violence and human rights issues. So I think that's really why the authorities were irritated with our project. And in the end, of course, while making our work in the North Caucasus, we got arrested over and over again because it's a really sensitive area.
When was the last time you were there?
The last time was in June, I think, last year. And in July, we heard that we didn't get a new visa.
Arnold van Bruggen is a filmmaker and part of the team that's produced the Sochi Project, a multi-year film, photo, and reporting effort that's going on as we speak. Arnold, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Face it, stories in the media about Muslim American men are more likely to be about terrorism threats than love or romance. But a new collection of essays by 22 Muslim American men sets out to change that narrative by letting readers into their love lives. Reporter Shuka Kalantari has a story.
Growing up, I lived in what you'd call a secular Muslim household. My family didn't pray 5 times a day, and we ate bacon. But there was one rule my parents always held on to.
It's not okay for you to have a boyfriend.
That's my mom. As a teenager, I wasn't supposed to look at boys or even think about boys. And I wasn't the only one. In Aisha Matu's last book, called Love Inshallah, she talks about challenges like mine for Muslim American women. But then Matu and her co-editor realized they only got half the story when they started hearing from Muslim men.
We were receiving emails by men who had read the first book. We were being stalked at dinner parties. We were being stopped on the street by our friends and acquaintances saying, "Where are our stories?"
Matu thought about the image of Muslim men in the U.S., especially post 9/11, and how it was pretty one-dimensional.
It's basically a terrorism frame. It's the scary Muslim frame.
Matu's now trying to change that with her new book called Salam Love, stories about Muslim American men. They range from candid essays on marriage to quirky stories about the awkwardness of asking a girl out on a date. Mohammed Shama, a software developer in Berkeley, knew he had a story to tell about growing up as an Egyptian-American first-generation Muslim in the U.S. He writes about how, for years, he tried reconciling the Islamic belief of chastity until marriage with the raging hormones of an adolescent boy. That duality came to a head when he was 11 years old, during an innocent game of spin the bottle.
There was probably about four or five of us. I was the only Muslim kid. It was the first time I ever kissed a girl. But my mom found out, and I got the silent treatment for several days. And I knew that I had to make up for it with a lot of prayer at home.
Shama says he was racked with guilt over having kissed a girl. His mom said it was a sin. But that didn't mean he'd stop.
I had to balance this world where I wanted to just be another American boy, and yet she wanted me to be this model Muslim boy.
Shama hopes his story will help counter the negative image of Muslims here, especially Muslims with Middle Eastern-sounding names.
Not only does having a name like Mohammed make me get stopped at TSA, having a son whose name is Kareem get stopped when he's 8 months old because he's on a list. That, to me, is something that needs to change. I don't need to show my 8-month-old to passport control to say, look, you don't have to be worried about this boy.
Shama says intimate stories like his can show Muslims in a different light and chip away at stereotypes.
But if we're willing to talk about love, we're making that step towards that mutual agreement that, hey, we're really the same person.
It's not just first-generation Muslims that deal with stigma or the complications that come with love. Stephen Leeper in Oakland also contributed to the book. He says as an African-American Muslim, it's often twice as hard.
Because the oppression is doubled, you know, of being black and being a Muslim.
Leeper talks about how it was taboo for him to share his feelings with his family and even some of his ex-girlfriends.
Where I was told that I was weak and I was womanly and that I had too many emotions.
Now Leeper is happily married and living in Oakland.
By me telling the story and the detail that I tell it with the amount of vulnerability that I tell it, it helps give permission to young African-American Muslim men and just young African-American men to feel safe to tell their story.
Editor Aisha Matu just opened the door, she says, and hundreds of essays from across the country poured in. Muslim Americans are the most racially diverse religious group in the U.S., Matu says this diversity is reflected in these love stories. For The World, I'm Shuka Kalantari, San Francisco.
When I was a kid and Sid Caesar had already become fodder for the nostalgia machine, my dad took me to a movie theater where they were playing old episodes of Your Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour. I thought about that yesterday when I heard Sid Caesar had died at the age of 91. Today I spoke with his longtime friend and straight man, Carl Reiner.
Sid was the greatest double talker in the world, and in my act I had double talk. And I said, well, this is something I'll never do again on the show because Sid was a master, and nobody ever did it as well as he did.
And explain for our younger listeners, including myself, what double talk is.
Double talk is making the sounds of foreign languages without actually using real words. It's a little sound like a French talking.
I thought you were speaking
like
French.
I talk French, but I was almost talking French. And
right.
It was able to do that in almost every language that existed, including Chinese and Japanese.
It's very funny. That's the stuff that I really, really relish. I mean, we're about to hear that great bit of the German general, and Sid Caesar was such a master of that mimicry and of sounding foreign. What was your favorite moment of performing with Sid Caesar?
All of the foreign movies I love doing. One of my favorite movies was the greatest silent movie star of all time, and then sound came in. And Sid's voice, when he heard that sound was in, he said, at last the world will hear my voice. He had the voice of a turtle.
Comedian Carl Reiner there. And the double talk that he spoke about was the shtick of one of my favorite Sid Caesar sketches, The German General. And if you know what he's saying, chances are you don't speak German. Rabbi Moshe Waldux gets it, though. He is the co-editor of the Big Book of Jewish Humor. And there's something in that clip of him doing this gibberish of the German general. His parents were immigrants, right? Mother from Russia, father from Poland. Was this how all that started, just hearing a lot of languages when he's growing up?
I think that's part of it. Of course, he lived in New York City, and I think it was Yonkers, really, but he heard a lot of immigrant voices. Also, you should bear in mind that radio in the 1930s was far more multicultural than it is today. So you had characters on all of the comedy shows who spoke in accents.
And he got his start on radio, not on TV.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But he was a musician primarily, and a lot of, I think, musicians and language fit together. He heard the lilting rhythm of the language. He obviously threw a lot of Yiddish in, because that's where he probably grew up hearing a lot of Yiddish, but it's tone, and that's what he was a master at, of capturing the tone of all the different groups. And he could speak in speak poorly in almost every dialect that there was.
Right. It wasn't just German. He was
Italian,
able to do
French,
Italian.
Right.
Now, there's one story, I don't know if it's true or not, when he's kind of working his thing in the Borscht Belt in the Catskills, and there's this bit that he did about an Italian opera.
Correct.
And how did that work? I mean,
well,
was he
the
doing
Borscht
kind of...
Belt, those who don't know, the Borscht Belt is, it was an area in the so-called mountains. They really aren't mountains, they're hills,
right,
about 90 minutes north of New York, and there were a lot of hotels, and hardworking people would take their 2 weeks off and go there, and they wanted two things, to eat more than they could and to laugh more than they could. And they had these troops of people that were called tumblers, and they would try to get people going. And Caesar got his training there, as well as others, Karl Reiner, Mel Brooks, etc. And one night, they're out of all material. So they got to improvise. And he says, well, what do we could do tonight? You know, he says, let's do Rigoletto. He says, well, we don't know Rigoletto. Don't worry, they don't either. And they went out and they did this phony opera again using the accents. It just got laughs because of the fact that it was conceptually absurd. So he, in a sense, was a conceptual comedian.
Digging into his big bag of linguistic tricks from New York. So he had to have been a groundbreaking comic, because a lot of people see your show of shows as a precursor to Saturday Night Live.
Absolutely. And it employs an essentially Jewish form, which is parody. And this Jewish form, of course, was taken to its height by Mel Brooks, who every film of his basically is a parody of another film. And I think parody, on the one hand, is a sense of homage, but it's also making fun of certain genres that they take themselves too seriously. And I think parody on the show of shows was precisely that. They took TV shows of the time, very much like Saturday Night Live, and I think much better, personally, than some years of Saturday Night Live.
One thing that did carry through, clearly, from Sid Caesar was that kind of foreign language gibberish again, and you can hear it almost entirely lifted from Sid Caesar in John Belushi's Samurai. Here, listen to this.
And now, another episode of Samurai Delicatessen.
Can I have a sandwich, please?
Maybe he was ordering a sushi sandwich. I don't think he was speaking Japanese, right, though.
By the way, the character that Sid Caesar played, the same character, he called Taka Mishigshiga, which, for those who knew Yiddish, meant really crazy. So there was always a subliminal thing going out to the Jews in the audience, even though there was no overt Jewish context by titles they gave things, etc.
So when you draw the connection between Sid Caesar and John Belushi doing Samurai Delicatessen, for example, is this Jewish humor? Is it American humor? What is it?
Well, I think the great contribution of Jews to the United States, besides winning a couple of Nobel Prizes, I think has been the creation of an American humor. The same way blacks created jazz, but now we don't say black jazz anymore. We say American jazz. Same thing with humor. They brought the urban wit, starting with the Marx Brothers all the way through. The idea of fast-paced humor using parody, that didn't exist in the Southern humor. So-called frontier humor, the Will Rogers kind of thing, slow. And this was a tension in the United States in the 20s, you know, between the new urban ethnics and the white Southerners. And I think it's still a tension.
Yeah.
It might still be a tension today.
May have a point there.
Yeah.
Moshe Waldux, co-editor of the Big Book of Jewish Humor. He's also a rabbi at an independent congregation, Temple Beth Zion, in Brookline, Massachusetts. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Thank you for having me.
Yep, that's the master of mimicry, Sid Caesar, performing the Italian opera Pagliacci. Ma, Bravo. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Timing is everything, don't you know? But timing at the Winter Olympics, well, it's weird. This week, two skiers in the women's downhill race clocked the same exact fastest time, 1 minute and 41.57 seconds. Officials called it a tie, and the two skiers both got gold medals, a first for the Winter Olympics. That might not have happened if the two athletes had been speeding down the luge track. That competition is measured down to the thousandth of a second. Turns out each sports federation determines the timing rules.
We have to time what's in the rule is and what the federation is asking for.
That's Peter Huseler with Omega. The Swiss watchmaker has been the official timekeeper of the Olympic Games since 1932, and things were a little different back then.
In the beginning, when they started in 32, it was in seconds.
So from timing down to the second back in 1932 to what now?
We can go to 1 millionth of a second if you want.
So why not do that for downhill skiing? Well, the International Ski Federation says it's worried about the integrity of the time when it gets down to such small numbers. So the FIS has no plans to change the rules. But I'm still thinking a lot can happen in just a hundredth of a second. Huseler breaks it down in terms of the distance a speeding downhill skier could cover with that tiny amount of time.
1 hundredth of a second, it's a distance for 26 centimeters.
So somebody was, in fact, ahead, right? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe. I don't know.
You'd think a man who's been the chief timekeeper at 16 Olympics would be bothered by such lack of precision, but Omega's Peter Huseler thinks there's nothing wrong with sticking to the rules as they are.
If they are precise the same time, each one merit a gold medal or a silver medal, that's correct.
Finally today, we want to introduce you to one of the skiers who's making a small splash at the Winter Olympics. He is the first ever Olympic skier representing East Timor, the small island nation in Asia. But do you know what East Timor is officially called at the Olympics? That's our Flash GeoQuiz for you today. Johan Gut Gonsalves is in his room in the Olympic Village in Sochi. What is your country called at the Olympics officially? What's the name?
Well, it's called Democratic Republic of Timor-Leste.
Republic of Timor-Leste. So Timor-Leste is that East Timor in Portuguese?
Yes. Actually, now the government in Timor wants everybody to call it Timor-Leste, actually.
Right. You're the sole representative from Timor-Leste at the Olympics. How's the skiing back in Timor-Leste?
Never really snowed in Timor-Leste, so there's no skiing in Timor. So yeah, basically they never saw the snow there.
I heard that there is no word for skiing in Timor-Leste.
Yeah, the word doesn't exist, so they call it the snow skating. Patinhos de neve.
Patinhos de neve.
Patinhos de neve, yeah.
I love it. Yeah, so how did you get into the sport in the first place?
My mom, I often say that my mom gave me the heritage, the spirit and the blood. And my dad gave me this very French thing that in winter we go skiing. So
your dad is French and your mother is East Timorese?
Yeah. So I basically combine both.
You ever met anybody else in East Timor who skis?
Well, my brother skis in East Timorese as well.
You must know, you know, the cool running story, the Jamaican bobsled team's unlikely tale of their sport. Do you ever worry that you're being seen also as kind of an oddity, like the Timor-Leste skier?
Well, I get quite a lot of really, really strong messages from my brothers and sisters, my people in Timor, really powerful and strong messages. And they tell me that they don't really understand what I'm doing, but as long as I'm bringing the flag to the world, they will always be here. And they gave me a title in Timor, and ambassador of youth and sport.
Wow.
In Timor.
Do you feel like an ambassador?
I think every athlete at the Winter Olympics is one. And I really believe that this was one of my main jobs here, to show to the world this little country that nobody knows and nobody can put on a map. So, yeah, I really believe that I'm a skier and as well maybe an ambassador for Timor.
Other unlikely places at the Olympics, like Jamaica, have not seen the same sort of civil strife as East Timor. More than 100,000 people died in fighting there in the 80s and 90s. I'm just wondering how all of this weighs on you as an athlete representing not just a country, but these people and what they've been through.
Yeah, actually, basically, my mom escaped just when the war started, but a lot of my family stayed. I have a lot of my family members that died during this war, and my grandmother stayed as a resistance, and a few of my uncles stayed in the bushes to fight. So in a way, my mother's side family is really attached to this country, and it's important to not forget, but it's good to go forwards, one step forwards, and not stay on the past and the sadness. And I think sports is a really good thing to make it bigger to the world. If you don't know the country, and just go open a map and have a look where it is, or type the name of Timor-Leste on Google and just read the story of this country. And I really hope that my job will make Timor bigger.
And so far, how you doing? What's your favorite moment so far at the Olympics?
Well, of course, the opening ceremony was really big for me. Just catching that moment for it to stay all my life in my head. And of course, the joy of being with other athletes that had the same dream as mine. And of course, the skiing is wonderful, and skiing next to the greatest. It's really, really awesome as well.
You know, we always close our show down with a little music,
yes.
Johan. Is there a song that you have in your head while you're coming down the slopes?
This morning I was listening to this new rap group in Timor that I was, just listening.
Olympic skier Johan Gut Gonsalves representing
Timor-Leste.
Timor-Leste, the answer to our GeoQuiz today. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Charlie Roscoe and Yano Viegas from Timor-Leste have the last words on the program today. Thanks to East Timorese skier Johan Gut Gonsalves for tipping us off. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in a very snowy Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.